Good morning and welcome to Occupy the Airwaves. All right, I know you've been waiting all week for the second part of this interview with Mike Bentz, former State Department official who explains why and when they started censoring. And now he's going to explain the how to you. So without further ado, let's get into it here.
The Atlanta Council, for example, was a part of this government-funded consortium, something called the Virality Project, which mapped 66 different narratives that dissidents were talking about around COVID, everything from COVID origins to vaccine efficacy. And then they broke down these 66 claims into all the different factual subclaims. And then they plugged these into these essentially machine learning models to be able to have a constant world heat map of what everybody was saying about COVID. And whenever something started to trend that was bad for what the Pentagon wanted or was bad for what Tony Fauci wanted, they were able to take down tens of millions of posts. They did this in the 2020 election with mail-in ballots. It was the
there's so much here and it's so shocking. So you're saying the Pentagon, the U.S. Department of Defense, censored Americans during the 2020 election cycle?
Yes. Oh, they did this through the two most censored events in human history, I would argue, to date, are the 2020 election and the COVID-19 pandemic. I'll explain how I arrived there. So the 2020 election was determined by mail-in ballots. And I'm not weighing into the substance of whether mail-in ballots were or were not a legitimate or safe and reliable form of voting. That's a completely independent topic from my perspective than the censorship issue one. But the censorship of mail-in ballots is really one of the most extraordinary stories in our American history, I would argue. What happened was you had this plot within the Department of Homeland Security. Now, this gets back to what we were talking about with the State Department's Global Engagement Center. You had this group within the Atlanta Council and the foreign policy establishment, which began arguing in 2017 for the need for a permanent domestic censorship government office to serve as a quarterback for what they called a whole of society counter misinformation, counter disinformation alliance. That just means censorship, the counter misdisinfo. But their whole of society model explicitly proposed that we need every single asset within society to be mobilized in a whole of society effort to stop misinformation online. It was that much of an existential threat to democracy. But they fixated in 2017 that it had to be centered within the government because only the government would have the clout and the coercive threat powers and the perceived authority to be able to tell the social media companies what to do, to be able to summon a government-funded NGO swarm to create that media surround sound, to be able to arm, you know, an astroturfed army of fact-checkers, and to be able to liaise and connect all these different censorship industry actors into a cohesive, unified whole. And the Atlanta Council initially proposed with this blueprint called Forward Defense. It's not offense, it's forward defense, guys. They initially proposed that running this out of the State Department's Global Engagement Center because they had so many assets there who were so effective at censorship under Rick Stengelstein, under the Obama administration. But they said, oh, we're not going to be able to get away with that because we don't really have a national security predicate, and it's supposed to be foreign-facing. We can't really use that hook unless we have a sort of national security one. Then they contemplated parking it the CIA. And they said, well, actually, there's two reasons we can't do that. The CIA is foreign-facing. We can't really establish a counterintelligence threat to bring it home domestically. Also, we're going to need essentially tens of thousands of people involved in this operation, spanning this whole society model. You can't really run a clandestine operation that way. So they said, okay, well, what about the FBI? They said, well, the FBI would be great. It's domestic. But the problem is the FBI is supposed to be the intelligence arm of the Justice Department. And what we're dealing with here are not acts of lawbreaking. It's basically support for Trump. Or if a left-wing populist had risen to power like Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, they would have done the same thing to him there. They targeted Jeremy Corbyn and other left-wing populist NATO skeptical groups in Europe. But in the US, it was all Trump. And so essentially what they said is, well, the only other domestic intelligence equity we have in the US besides the FBI is the DHS. So we are going to essentially take the CIA's power to rig and bribe foreign media organizations, which is a power they've had since the day they were born in 1947, and we're going to combine that with the domestic jurisdiction of the FBI by putting it at DHS. So DHS was basically deputized. It was empowered through this obscure little cybersecurity agency to have the combined powers that the CIA has abroad with the jurisdiction of the FBI at home. And the way they did this, how did an obscure little cybersecurity agency get this power, was they did a funny little series of switcheroos. So this little thing called CISA, they didn't call it the Disinformation Governance Board, they didn't call it the Censorship Agency. They gave it an obscure little name that no one would notice called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, who its founder said, we just care about security so much it's in our name twice. You know, everybody sort of closed their eyes and pretended, you know, that's what it was. But it was created by Act of Congress in 2018 because of the perceived threat that Russia had hacked the 2016 election, had physically hacked it, and so we needed the cybersecurity power to be able to deal with that. And essentially on the heels of a CIA memo on January 6, 2017, and a same-day DHS executive order on January 6, 2017, arguing that Russia had interfered in the 2016 election, and a DHS mandate saying that elections are now critical infrastructure, you had this new power within DHS to say that cybersecurity attacks on elections are now our purview. And then they did two cute things. One, they said mis, dis, and malinformation online are a form of cybersecurity attack. They are a cyber attack because they are happening online. And they said, well, actually, Russian disinformation is, we're actually protecting democracy and elections. We don't need a Russian predicate after Russiagate died. So just like that, you had this cybersecurity agency be able to legally make the argument that your tweets about mail-in ballots, if you undermine public faith and confidence in them as a legitimate form of voting, was now, you were now conducting a cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure by articulating misinformation on Twitter. And just like that, now what they did then is they
complaining about election fraud is the same as taking down our power grid.
Yes. You could literally be on your toilet seat at 9:30 on Thursday night and tweet, I think that mail-in ballots are illegitimate. And you were essentially then caught up in the crosshairs of the Department of Homeland Security classifying you as conducting a cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure because you were doing misinformation online in the cyber realm, and misinformation is a cyber attack on democracy when it undermines public faith and confidence in our democratic elections and our democratic institutions. They would end up going far beyond that. They would actually define democratic institutions as being another thing that was a cyber security attack to undermine. And lo and behold, the mainstream media is considered a democratic institution. That would come later. What ended up happening was, in advance of the 2020 election, starting in April of 2020, although this goes back before, you had this essentially never Trump neocon Republican DHS working with essentially NATO on the national security side and essentially the DNC, if you will, to use DHS as the launching point for a government-coordinated mass censorship campaign spanning every single social media platform on Earth in order to pre-censor the ability to dispute the legitimacy of mail-in ballots. And here's how they did this. They aggregated four different institutions: Stanford University, the University of Washington, a company called Graphica, and the Atlanta Council. Now, all four of these institutions, the centers within them, were essentially Pentagon cutouts. You had at the Stanford Internet Observatory, it was actually run by Michael McFaul. If you know Michael McFaul, he was the U.S. ambassador to Russia under the Obama administration, and he personally authored a seven-step playbook for how to successfully orchestrate a color revolution. And part of that involved maintaining total control over media and social media, juicing up the civil society outfits, calling elections illegitimate. Now, mind you, all of these people were professional Russiagaters and professional election delegitimizers in 2016. And then, I'll get to that in a second. So Stanford University, nominally the Stanford Internet Observatory under Michael McFaul, was run by Alex Stamos, who was formerly a Facebook executive who coordinated with ODNI with respect to Russiagate, you know, taking down Russian propaganda at Facebook. So this is another liaison, essentially, to the national security state. And under Alex Stamos at Stanford Internet Observatory was Renee DiResta, who started her career in the CIA and wrote the Senate Intelligence Committee report on Russian disinformation. And there's a lot more there that I'll get to another time. But the next institution was the University of Washington, which is essentially the Bill Gates University in Seattle, who is headed by Kate Starbird, who is basically three generations of military brass, who got her PhD in crisis informatics, essentially doing, you know, social media surveillance for the Pentagon and getting DARPA funding and working essentially with the national security state, then repurposed to take on mail-in ballots. The third firm, Graphica, got $7 million in Pentagon grants and got their start as part of the Pentagon's Minerva Initiative. The Minerva Initiative is the psychological warfare research center of the Pentagon. This group was doing social media spying and narrative mapping for the Pentagon until the 2016 election happened, and then were repurposed into a partnership with the Department of Homeland Security to censor, you know, 22 million pro-Trump tweets about mail-in ballots. And then the fourth institution, as I mentioned, was the Atlantic Council, who's got seven CIA directors on the board. So one after another, it is exactly what Ben Rhodes described it during the Obama era as the blob. The foreign policy establishment, Defense Department, the State Department, or the CIA, every single time. And of course, this was because they were threatened by Trump's foreign policy. And so while much of the censorship looks like it's coming domestically, it's actually by our foreign-facing Department of Dirty Tricks Color Revolution blob, who are professional government topplers, who were then basically descended on the 2020 election. Now, they did this. They explicitly said, the head of this election integrity partnership, on tape, and my foundation clipped them, and it's been played before Congress, and it's in, you know, a part of the Missouri v. Biden lawsuit now, but they explicitly said on tape that they were set up to do what the government was banned from doing itself. And then they articulated a multi-step framework in order to coerce all the tech companies to take censorship actions. They said on tape the tech companies would not have done but for their pressure, which involved using threats of government force because they were the deputized arm of the government. They had a formal partnership with the DHS. They were able to use DHS's proprietary domestic disinformation switchboard to immediately talk to top brass at all the tech companies for takedowns. And they bragged on tape about how they got the tech companies to all systematically adopt a new terms of service speech violation ban called delegitimization, which meant any tweet, any YouTube video, any Facebook post, any TikTok video, any Discord post, any Twitch video, anything on the internet that undermined public faith and confidence in the use of mail-in ballots or early voting drop boxes or ballot tabulation issues on election day was a prima facie terms of service violation policy under this new delegitimization policy that they only adopted because of pass-through government pressure from the Election Integrity Partnership, which they bragged about on tape, including the grid that they used to do this, and simultaneously invoking threats of government breaking them up or government stopping doing favors for the tech companies unless they did this, as well as inducing crisis PR by working with their media allies. And they said the government, DHS, could not do that themselves, and so they set up this basically constellation of State Department, Pentagon, and IC networks to run this pre-censorship campaign, which by their own math had 22 million tweets on Twitter alone. And mind you, they just on 15 platforms. So this is hundreds of millions of posts, which were all scanned and banned or throttled so that they could not be amplified, or they exist in a sort of limited state purgatory, or had these frictions affixed to them in the form of fact-checking labels where you couldn't actually click through to the thing, or you had to, it was an inconvenience to be able to share it. Now, they did this 7 months before the election, because at the time, they were worried about the perceived legitimacy of a Biden victory in the case of a so-called red mirage, blue shift event. They knew the only way that Biden would be able to win mathematically was through the disproportionate Democrat use of mail-in ballots. They knew there would be a crisis because it was going to look extremely weird if Trump looked like he won by seven states. And then 3 days later, it comes out, actually, the election switched. I mean, that would put the election crisis of the Bush-Gore election on a level of steroids that the national security state said, well, the public will not be prepared for. So what we need to do is we need to, in advance, we need to pre-censor the ability to even question the legitimacy. This took out—
Wait, may I ask you to pause right there? So what you're saying is, what you're suggesting is, they knew the outcome of the election 7 months before it was held.
It looks very bad. Certainly what they
Yes, Mike, it does look very bad.
You know, and especially when you combine this with the fact that this is right on the heels of the impeachment, the Pentagon-led, CIA-led impeachment. You know, it was Eric Ciamarella from the CIA, and it was the Vindmans from the Pentagon who led the impeachment of Trump in late 2019 over, you know, an alleged phone call around withholding Ukraine aid. This same network, which came straight out of the Pentagon hybrid warfare military censorship network created after the first, you know, Ukraine crisis in 2014, were the lead architects of the Ukraine impeachment in 2019, and then essentially came back on steroids as part of the 2020 election censorship operation. But, you know, from their perspective, I mean, It certainly looks like the perfect crime. These were the people DHS at the time had actually federalized much of the National Election Administration through this January 6, 2017 executive order from outgoing Obama DHS head Jed Johnson, which essentially wrapped all 50 states up into a formal DHS partnership. So DHS was simultaneously in charge of the administration of the election in many respects and the censorship of anyone who challenged the administration of the election. This is like, you know, putting essentially the defendant of a trial as the judge and jury of the trial.
But you're not describing democracy. I mean, you're describing a country in which democracy is impossible.
What I'm essentially describing is military rule. I mean, this is, I mean, what's happened with the rise of the censorship industry is a total inversion of the idea of democracy itself. You know, democracy sort of draws its legitimacy from the idea that it is ruled by consent of the people being ruled. That is, it's not really being ruled by an overlord because the government is actually just our will expressed by our consent with who we vote for. The whole push after the 2016 election and after Brexit and after a couple of other, you know, social media run elections that went the wrong way from what the State Department wanted, like the 2016 Philippines election, was to completely invert everything that we described as being the underpinnings of a democratic society in order to deal with the threat of free speech on the internet. And what they essentially said is we need to redefine democracy from being about the will of the voters to being about the sanctity of democratic institutions. And who are the democratic institutions? Oh, it's us. You know, it's the military, it's NATO, it's the IMF and the World Bank, it's the mainstream media, it is the NGOs, and of course these NGOs are largely State Department funded or IC funded. It's essentially all of the elite establishments that were under threat from the rise of domestic populism that declared their own consensus to be the new definition of democracy. Because if you define democracy as being the strength of democratic institutions, rather than a focus on the will of the voters, then what you're left with is essentially democracy is just the consensus building architecture within the democratic institutions themselves. And from their perspective, that takes a lot of work. I mean, the amount of work these people do, I mean, for example, we mentioned the Atlantic Council, which is one of these big coordinating mechanisms for the oil and gas industry in a region, for the finance and the JP Morgans and the Black Rocks in a region, for the NGOs in the region, for the media in the region. All of these need to reach a consensus, and that process takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of work and a lot of negotiation. From their perspective, that's democracy. Democracy is getting the NGOs to agree with BlackRock, to agree with the Wall Street Journal, you know, to agree with, you know, the community and activist groups who are onboarded with respect to a particular initiative. That is the difficult vote building process from their perspective. At the end of the day, a bunch of, you know, populist groups decide that they like a truck driver who's popular on TikTok more than the, you know, carefully constructed consensus of the NATO military brass. Well, then from their perspective, you know, that is now an attack on democracy. And this is what this whole branding effort was. And of course, democracy again has that magic regime change predicate, where democracy is our magic watchword to be able to overthrow governments from the ground up in a sort of color revolution style whole of society effort to topple a democratically elected government from the inside. For example, as we did in Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych was democratically elected by the Ukrainian people, like him or hate him. I'm not even issuing an opinion there. But the fact is we color revolutioned him out of office. We January 6th him out of office, yes. Actually, if to be frank. I mean, with respect to the State Department funded right sector thugs and, you know, $5 billion worth of civil society money pumped into this to overthrow a democratically elected government in the name of democracy. And they took that special set of skills home. And now it's here, perhaps potentially to stay. And this has fundamentally changed the nature of American governance because of the threat of, you know, one small voice becoming popular on social media.
May I ask you a question? So into that group of institutions that you say now define democracy, the NGOs, foreign policy establishment, et cetera, you included the mainstream media. Now, in 2021, the NSA broke into my private text apps, read them, and then leaked them to the New York Times against me. That just happened again to me last week. And I'm wondering how common that is for the intel agencies to work with so-called mainstream media like the New York Times to hurt their opponents.
Well, that is the function of these interstitial government-funded non-governmental organizations and think tanks like, for example, we mentioned the Atlantic Council, which is, you know, NATO's think tank, but other groups like the Aspen Institute, which draws the lion's share of its funding from the State Department and other government agencies. You know, the Aspen Institute was busted doing the same thing with the Hunter Biden laptop censorship. You know, you had this strange situation where the FBI had advanced knowledge of the pending publication of the Hunter Biden laptop story. And then magically, the Aspen Institute, which is run by essentially former CIA, former NSA, former FBI, and then a bunch of sort of civil society organizations, all hold a mass stakeholder censorship simulation, a three-day conference. You know, this came out and Joel Roth was there. This is a big part of the Twitter file leaks, and it's been mentioned in multiple congressional investigations. But somehow, the Aspen Institute, which is basically an addendum of the national security state, got the exact same information that the national security state spied on journalists and political figures to obtain, and not only leaked it, but then basically did a joint coordinated censorship simulator in September, 2 months before the election, in order, just like with the censorship of mail-in ballots, to be in ready position to pre-censor anyone online, amplifying
wait a second.
News story that had not even broken yet.
The Aspen Institute? So, I mean, which is, by the way, I spent my life in Washington. It's kind of a, I mean, Walter Isaacson, formerly of Time Magazine, ran it. Former president of CNN. I had no idea it was part of the National Security State. I had no idea its funding came from the U.S. government. This is the first time I've ever heard that. But given, assuming what you're saying is true, it's a little weird that Walter Isaacson left Aspen Institute to write a biography of Elon Musk. Strange or no?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't read that book. From what I've heard from people, it's a relatively fair treatment. You know, just total speculation. But I suspect that Walter Isaacson has struggled with this issue and may not even firmly fall in one particular place, in the sense that, you know, Walter Isaacson did a series of interviews of Rick Stengel, actually with the Atlantic Council and in other settings, where he interviewed Rick Stengel specifically on the issue of the need to get rid of the First Amendment and the threat that free speech on social media poses to democracy. Now, at the time, I was very concerned. This was between 2017 and 2019 when he did these Rick Stengel interviews. I was very concerned because Isaacson expressed what seemed to me to be a highly sympathetic view about the Rick Stengel perspective on killing the First Amendment. Now, he didn't formally endorse that position, but it left me very skittish about Isaacson. But what I should say is, at the time, I don't think very many people, in fact, I know virtually nobody in the country, had any idea how deep the rabbit hole went when it came to the construction of the censorship industry and how deep the tentacles had grown within the military and the national security state in order to buoy and consolidate it. Much of that, frankly, did not even come to public light till even last year. Some of that was galvanized by Elon Musk's acquisition and the Twitter files and the Republican turnover in the House that allowed these multiple investigations, the lawsuits like Missouri v. Biden, the discovery process there. You know, multiple other things like the Disinformation Governance Board, who, by the way, the interim head of that, you know, the head of that, Nina Jankowicz, got her start in the censorship industry from this exact same clandestine intelligence community censorship network created after the 2014 Crimea situation. Nina Jankowicz, when her name came up in 2022 as part of the Disinformation Governance Board, I almost fell out of my chair because I had been tracking Nina's network for almost 5 years at that point when her name came up as part of the UK inner cluster cell of a busted clandestine operation to censor the internet called the Integrity Initiative, which was created by the UK Foreign Office and was backed by NATO's political affairs unit in order to carry out this thing that we talked about at the beginning of this dialogue, the NATO sort of psychological inoculation and the ability to kill so-called Russian propaganda or rising political groups who wanted to maintain energy relations with Russia at a time when the U.S. was trying to kill the Nord Stream and other pipeline relations.
Well, they did that.
Nina Jankowicz was a part of this outfit. And then who was the head of it after Nina Jankowicz went down? It was Michael Chertoff. And Michael Chertoff was running the Institute cyber group. And the Aspen Institute then goes on to be the censorship simulator for the Hunter Biden laptop story. And then 2 years later, Chertoff is then the head of the Disinformation Governance Board after Nina is forced to step down.
Yeah, close friends.
Of course, Michael Chertoff was the chairman at Bay Sorry.
Of course.
You know, Michael Toff was the chairman of the largest military contractor in Europe, BAE Military.
So you've blown my mind so many times in this conversation that I'm going to need a nap directly after it's done. So I've just got two more questions for you. One short, one a little longer. Short one is, for people who've made it this far and want to know more about this topic, but for people who want to do research on their own, how can your research on this be found on the internet?
Sure. So our foundation is foundationforfreedomonline.com. We publish all manner of reports on every aspect of the censorship industry, from what we talked about with the role of the military-industrial complex and the national security state, to what the universities are doing, to, you know, I sometimes refer to as digital MK Ultra. There's just the field of basically the science of censorship and how, and the funding of these psychological manipulation methods in order to nudge people into different belief systems, as they did with COVID, as they did with energy, and every sensitive policy issue is what they essentially had an ambition for. My foundationforfreedomonline.com website is one way. The other way is just on X. My handle is at Mike Ben Cyber. I'm very active there and publish a lot of long-form video and written content on all this. I think it's one of the most important issues in the world today.
So it certainly is. And so that leads directly and seamlessly to my final question, which is about X. And I'm not just saying this because I post content there, but I think objectively it's the last big platform that's free, or sort of free, or more free. You know, we're at the very beginning of an election year with a couple of different wars unfolding simultaneously in 2024. So do you expect that that platform can stay free for the duration of this year?
It's under an extraordinary amount of pressure, and that pressure is going to continue to mount as the election approaches. Elon Musk is a very unique individual, and he has a unique buffer, perhaps, when it comes to the national security state, because the national security state is actually quite reliant on Elon Musk properties, whether that's for the electrical, you know, the sort of the green revolution when it comes to Tesla and the battery technology there. When it comes to SpaceX, the State Department is hugely dependent on SpaceX because of its unbelievable pioneering and saturating presence in the field of low Earth orbit satellites that are basically how our telecom, you know, system runs, to things like Starlink. There are dependencies that the national security state has on Elon Musk. I'm not sure he'd have as much room to negotiate if he had become the world's richest man selling, you know, at a lemonade stand. So the national security state goes too hard on him by invoking something like CFIUS to sort of nationalize some of these properties. I think the shockwave that it would send to the international investor community would be irrecoverable at a time when we're engaged in great power competition. So trying to sort of induce a sort of corporate regime change through a series of things involving a sort of death by a thousand paper cuts. I think there are 7 or 8 different Justice Department or SEC or FTC investigations into Elon Musk properties that all started after his acquisition of X. But then what they're trying to do right now is what I call the transatlantic flank attack 2.0. You know, we talked in this dialogue about how the censorship industry really got its start when a bunch of State Department exiles who were expecting promotions took their special set of skills in coercing European countries to pass sanctions on themselves, to cut off their own leg despite themselves, in order to pass sanctions on Russia. They ran back that same playbook with doing a roadshow for censorship instead for sanctions. We are now witnessing transatlantic flank attack 2.0, if you will, which is because they have lost a lot of their federal government powers to do this same censorship operation they had been doing from 2018 to 2022, in part because the House has totally turned on them, in part because of the media, in part because Missouri v. Biden, which won a slam dunk case actually banning government censorship at the trial court and appellate court levels, is now before the Supreme Court. They've now moved into two strategies. One of them is state-level censorship laws. California just passed a new law which the censorship industry totally drove from start to finish. They call it Platform Accountability and Transparency, which is basically forcing, you know, Elon Musk to give over the kind of narrative mapping data that these CIA conduits and Pentagon cutouts were using to create these weapons of mass deletion, these abilities to just censor everything at scale because they had all the internal platform data. Elon Musk took that away. They're using state laws like this new California law to crack that open. But the major threat right now is the threat from Europe with the EU Digital Services Act. You can bet with 65 elections around the globe this year, predict every single time what they're going to define disinformation as.
Okay, sorry, I had to cut out a lot. I really am sorry about that, but it was longer than 30 minutes. So you can go and listen to it yourself. It is one of the most important interviews I've ever heard, and I encourage everyone to listen. And I think I'm really proud of people like Mike Benz, who stand up for the First Amendment and what our ancestors gave us. Let's not blow it, dudes. Come on now. Don't mess up. That's the end of Occupy the Air. We'll see you next week.